Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously little fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, the Agenda 21 rolling train that we like to call the island jewel of New Zealand. Oh yes, it's so beautiful. It's so gorgeous, especially when you have criminal bankster elite scumbaggery running the entire country into the ground, kind of as if it was like a titanic struggle against an iceberg dotted around and sinking, very, very badly sinking to the bottom of the ground floor, where there will be nothing left for people to live in, no houses, no nothing. That's New Zealand. Welcome. I love this country. You kick people out of their homes after they've been living there for goodness knows how long. And also, you get criminal bankster elite scumbaggery to run the country into the ground. I love it. Can we repeat that one more time? No, I don't think it's absolutely necessary. But we'll get some elaboration on it instead from my very special guest, Penny Bride. Penny, welcome to the program.
Oh, g'day, Vinny.
Now, can you explain to people just a little bit about who you are and what you do, and then we'll get into some of the news that you've been covering of late.
Okay. Yeah, my name's Penny Bright, and I'm media spokesperson for a group called the Water Pressure Group, and that's where things pretty much started off, fighting against the commercialisation and privatisation of water services and also user pays. And then, yeah, through that got involved in the council and then discovered how little transparency and accountability we had, and now I've ended up being an anti-corruption campaigner. I've been to two significant anti-corruption conferences, and New Zealand's perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, which has got to be the biggest steaming pile of the proverbial you've ever heard in your life. But there's been some really important breakthroughs over this last month on that front, actually. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go into it there. What exactly has been uncovered and what have you been up to the last month?
Well, over this last month, first of all, finally got a mainstream media hit on the fact that I've got a petition before the Commerce Select Committee, which is calling for an inquiry into basically how come two directors of this finance company, Hulich Wealth Management, how come they weren't charged for signing registered prospectuses which contained untrue statements? Because under New Zealand law, under the Securities Act, that is a strict liability offence. If you sign a prospectus which contains an untrue statement, you've committed an offence, end of story. And your only defence to that offence was that at the time of signing, you didn't know it was an untrue statement. Well, right now, in the country that's perceived to be the least corrupt in the world, the balance of power is effectively being held by someone who, in my opinion, is a yet-to-be-convicted white-collar criminal, and that is John Banks, the current leader of the ACT Party and the ACT Member of Parliament for Epsom. And so this is quite significant because what happened was, during the election campaign last year, I actually stood in Epsom against John Banks as a sort of public watchdog candidate, and I was trying to help shine a huge public spotlight on the fact that how come this one law for all, which was ACT Party policy, didn't apply to the ACT leader and this ACT MP, ACT candidate for Epsom. And what happened was that, I mean, I've been part of the Occupy Auckland movement, and what happened was a little group of us, we'd march off from Aotea Square where we'd been protesting, camping, and we marched on the offices of the Finance Markets Authority and handed over a letter, please lay charges against John Banks and Don Brash. And they put it in writing, they refused to do so. Then we marched about a week later on the offices of the Serious Fraud Office and asked them to apply one law for all against John Banks and Don Brash, and they put it in writing that they'd refused to do so. And then after Christmas, I sent a letter to the Auckland District Commander of Police asking that the police lay charges against John Banks and Don Brash, and they put in writing that they wouldn't either. So you've got to ask yourself, how is it that these two former directors haven't had the one law for all that they claim should apply to everybody else apply to them. Is it a form of corrupt political protection because Prime Minister John Key is dependent on that one vote of John Banks in order to maintain the balance of power, and they're his mates? Because Don Brash, he used to be the governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and John Banks claimed that he had 30 years commercial experience. Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, mum and dad investors, trust us, we know what we're doing, give us your money, and then next minute, oh shit, we didn't know what we were doing. How's that work? So anyway, so right now, this petition calling for an inquiry into prosecutions, or lack thereof, is an item of business before the Commerce Select Committee. And what's happening is in New Zealand, there are an increasing number of directors of other collapsed finance companies that are facing charges. And although some of the penalties may seem to be quite slack, which they are, at least they've been charged. So it's becoming increasingly untenable for charges not to be laid against John Banks and Don Brash. So it's quite exciting stuff. Yeah, so that's one thing. So we got a big article in the paper about petition stalks Banks and Brash. So first time ever to get mainstream media coverage. And then what's happened is subsequently there have been other developments, because during the Epsom election campaign, I campaigned on an action plan to prevent corruption, white-collar crime and corporate welfare. And where we've had a couple of king hits is the fact that New Zealand, although we're perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index, New Zealand hasn't even ratified the UN Convention Against Corruption. And the reason why New Zealand hasn't ratified the UN Convention Against Corruption is because our domestic legislative framework isn't yet in place. So it's a bit of a no-brainer. How on earth can we be the least corrupt country in the world if we haven't got a legislative framework in place to help stop corruption?
We don't have any protections virtually of any kind in this country. I mean, and it even goes down to, instead of just politicians and white-collar criminals being able to get away with whatever they want because they know the judges or they know the lawyers or whatever, working around behind the scenes, there's also the point with, even so far as police complaints get taken by other police.
Well, I know. But, I mean, so some major stuff here. I mean, how many people realise that New Zealand, perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, our MPs don't have an enforceable code of conduct? They make the rules for everybody else, but they themselves don't have an enforceable code of conduct, and neither do our judges. I mean, judges in New Zealand are out of control. They don't have an enforceable code of conduct. There's no register of pecuniary interests so that you can help avoid conflicts of interest with judges. And, of course, that's why a former Supreme Court judge was forced to resign in the end, because one of the counsel appearing before him was his business partner and he didn't recuse himself. Well, I mean, hello. I mean, how dodgy is that? And it was only when the judiciary actually had a bit of a split amongst themselves that the pressure built up to actually force this judge to resign. But a register of pecuniary interest where people can see, and it's available for public scrutiny, that helps to safeguard against these conflicts of interest. Because how can you guard against conflicts of interest if the interests are not declared and publicly available? So another big breakthrough has been, we've just recently got mainstream media coverage on the fact that our local government politicians, they don't have a register of pecuniary interest. Our MPs do, and that's available on our New Zealand government website, parliamentary website, so you can check. It's not a wealth register, so you don't know how many shares they've got, but you can see whether or not they do have shares in companies or the names of trust they're involved in. Well, that doesn't apply to local government politicians. So how dodgy is that? And when you combine that with the fact that we don't know where our public money is going, because the devil's in the detail, and we don't get the devilish detail. The question is, what are the names of the consultants or contractors? What is the scope of the contract? What is the term of the contract? And what is the value of the contract? And why information publicly available?
Now, what I love, Penny, is that these questions, they should be simple answers, right? We paid this guy this much for this job.
Yeah.
And it's carrying on for this amount of time, right? You'd figure that would be the stock standard practice of getting any kind of business done, but these people don't. And that just raises a huge red flag right there in the first place, either that they're completely incompetent or that they're completely corrupt.
Well, what's interesting is that elected representatives at local government level, they swear an oath. There's a public swearing-in ceremony where they swear an oath to the public, you know, to carry out their duties impartially and in the best interests of whatever area that they're from, and to follow the law and exercise prudent stewardship. But, I mean, how can you exercise prudent stewardship when you don't even know where the money's going? Because I've done a lot of research on this, and back in the days of Auckland City Council, what I discovered to my horror was that when you do all this contracting out, what happens is there's two layers of bureaucracy that you wouldn't normally have, because what happens is you have the contractors, but then you have to have contract management. And then you get these highly paid consultants that act as project managers of the works consultants. So instead of having a council works department where, you know, okay, the road needs fixing, will you get out there and get on with it? You have this layer upon layer of people getting huge amounts of money, all these private piggies in the middle with their snouts in our public trough. And, of course, the result is that rates, local body taxes, go up, not down. So all this crap that, you know, public is bad, private is good, and it's more efficient. Efficient is just corporate speak, because we want to get our filthy hands on it. So
well,
anyway,
I would suppose that's why they called Hewlett Wealth Management, because they managed to steal everybody's wealth.
Well, it's just really interesting, because in New Zealand, again, perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world, there's been over 60 collapsed finance companies since 2006. And what happened was that the old Securities Commission was deemed to be completely and utterly bloody useless. That's why it was replaced by this new Broome Finance Markets Authority. Well, when I went to the Finance Markets Authority and asked how come Banks and Brash hadn't been charged, they relied on the previous decision from the old Securities Commission. So you've got to ask yourself, well, if you're the new Broome, why aren't you independently reviewing the decision from the useless old group? Why are you relying on them? And then I find out that there's a number of people that actually transferred over from the old useless body to the new, supposedly not so useless body. So I've got a Dynamite Official Information Act request, which I'm waiting for, to find out upon whose legal advice were they relying to say, oh, no, there's no basis to charge, you know, this John Banks and Don Brash. Well, hello, who made this decision? And why? So the pressure is building up, and it's marvellous. But when it coming back to local government registers of interest, what I also discovered in my previous research was that in actual fact, you need to check the level of delegated authority, because a number of contracts up to a certain value, it's not elected representatives that sign them off. It's council staff or contractors or consultants or whatever. So the question has to be, why are there not registers of interest for any person that's responsible for property or procurement to double check for any possible conflicts of interest? And why isn't that information publicly available?
See, yeah. a drug dealer would never do business like this. You know, like you wouldn't give your drugs to somebody else and then just let them hold on to it and then come back to you without you weighing it again to make sure there's nothing missing. On the other hand, but when it comes, and that's criminals doing proper business. But when you have a look at the government, when you have a look at the government trying to allegedly do proper business, not being criminals, they do it even worse and dumber than any amount of drug messed up gang quandry mofos could ever do.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know anything about that, of course, Vinny.
Which comes down to my point that I've made on the show many times, is that the people in government are simply on crack. I mean, have a look at the symptoms of the people that are on crack, okay? Constantly lying all the time, stealing stuff all the time to pay for their habits. They make stuff up to cover their ass. They try and hide what they do from other people. I mean, if that's not government policy it's either government policy or the symptoms of somebody that's on a huge, huge quantity of crack, and they seem to be very similar.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I'm, you know, sort of simple revolting peasant and of the view that surely the public have got a right to know exactly where our public money is being spent. Is that not a fair question? I mean, if we're supposed to have open, transparent and democratically accountable government, centrally and locally, then why can't we find out exactly where the money's being spent?
Yeah, it's the old adage, follow that money. If you follow the money, it usually winds up leading to the source of the scumbaggery. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest from Auckland is Penny Bright, waterpressure.wordpress.com. You can call in, ladies and gentlemen, 218-339-8525. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're excited to get this into the Vinnie Eastwood Show here for you. We seem to have lost our guest, Penny Bright. She just kind of got disconnected there for a minute, so hopefully we can get the board up to bring her back up, if that's at all possible. Now, what I was talking about earlier on the show about the old Agenda 21 and what have you, you have a look at the government policies, local government, and I'm sure everybody can basically relate to this no matter which part of the world you're in. What I find is that it's so obvious once you know what you're looking for that you wonder how people can't see it. And it's simply because they don't know, and you do. And you simply sit there and you get more frustrated the fact that other people don't know, and you do. You know, you get angry with these people because, basically, they just don't understand. You're sitting here, and you don't know what's going on, and you're getting really increasingly even more angry because people aren't doing anything. It's this eternal circle of frustration. Why, ladies and gentlemen, why do people actually put up with this crap? It's taking a few seconds because, basically, no one anywhere has any idea how bad it can get. And so we're having a few technical difficulties here, so maybe we'd have to wait until get Penny on next segment. We're having a little bit of a problem here with the Skype, I think, man. And what I would like to do is actually kind of talk about how people can really notice, see, and identify Agenda 21 operating in your area, and it's all through local government. Okay, so I don't care whether you're in Texas, in England, or in New Zealand. The methodology works precisely the same, and I'd like to get some callers on this as well. 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Now, so if you think of local government as the power center of just your particular area, region, or whatever, you'd figure it had some kind of autonomy. It doesn't, not anymore. That's what Agenda 21 is supposed to do. It's supposed to turn all those local centres that have all the general power, you know, to collect rates from people, providing their water and power and general infrastructure and public transport, things like that. That's real power because it affects you right here, right now, in the particular area that you live. So the whole goal of Agenda 21 and ICLE, which is the group that's basically been put in place by the UN to see that this starts happening, this is the basic place that everything kind of stems from. Okay, they have a plan. Agenda 21 was signed in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit on on Prince Charles's private yacht. Jim Bolger, the Prime Minister of New Zealand at the time, as well as George H.W. Bush, the President of the United States at the time, both were there at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 and signed that document. So Agenda 21 is signed. We are ratified. We are kind of back up on it. And we've got Penny Bright back now. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with Agenda 21, Penny.
Probably not quite as familiar as I should be, but But in terms of the whole global agenda, I mean, it's not complicated. I mean, it's all about those with money wanting to take control over our resources and people on the planet. I mean, it ain't that complicated.
It's pretty straightforward. And that's what I find funny when people call me a conspiracy theorist for talking about this kind of stuff. It's like, yes, I'm a crazy conspiracy theorist. I believe people who have a lot of power and influence use their power and influence. I'm just absolutely nuts, aren't I?
Well, the interesting thing is in New Zealand, I mean, take our Prime Minister, Shonky John Key. I mean, you've got to ask yourself, in 2001, he was a foreign exchange advisor to the New York Federal Reserve, so you don't get much more Wall Street bankstery than that. And in 2002, next year, he sets on his career to become Prime Minister of New Zealand. Well, with all due respect, it's not complicated. John Key is a bankster. He's still a shareholder in the Bank of America. He's all about opening New Zealand up for foreign banksters and investors. It's as simple as that. And a really important example of that just happened recently. On the 21st of March, John Key, New Zealand Prime Minister, officiated at the opening of an Australian open cast coal mining company called Bathurst Resources Limited. And what they're trying to do is get resource consent to open cast coal mine on conservation estate land on the west coast. Well, the conflict of interest there is that a significant shareholder in Bathurst Resources Limited is the Bank of America. So would John Key stand to financially benefit from open cast coal mining on conservation estate land in New Zealand? Why, yes, I do believe he would. But, I mean, what happened was I sent out a press release. I've contacted the Green Party and New Zealand First and said, well, if it was good enough for National Party Minister for Minister Nick Smith to be forced to resign over a conflict of interest, which involved him signing a letter and helping someone out, which was a conflict of interest. This is surely far more significant, but it seems like it's too big and ugly and people don't quite want to go there because it's sort of enormous. Well, hello, it's a major conflict of interest. And in Australia, for example, John Key would not be allowed to openly own shares in the Bank of America. This is how corrupt we are. I mean, why do we have these business people in public positions? Where is the evidence that they know anything about public service ethics, ethos, serving the public? It seems that business people get into politics to maximise their own business opportunities, to look after themselves, their families and their mates, and never mind the public. And it's the total opposite of what people should be doing if they're elected to public office. It's the opposite.
Yeah. And this is not isolated to John Key either. Don't we also have a lot of other people within the National Party who are using public office for private gain or even getting big jobs with private companies right after being a minister, like our former Justice Minister Simon Power, right after coming out of Parliament, gets a job as what CEO of Westpac Bank? What bank does all the government's banking? Oh, yeah, that's right. It's Westpac. And then, you have a look even deeper at, say, like Pansy Wong, for instance. There was some New Zealand inventor of a really quite a revolutionary hovercraft design, and then she and her husband, Sammy Wong, took that design over to some of their business contacts in China. She was at the business meetings as a minister of parliament to give it more legitimacy, and they basically, for all intents and purposes, stole this guy's design and cut him completely out of the loop. And she's since been what happened to her? She got kicked out of Parliament as a result.
And then John Key.
It seems almost every single bit of a government policy he seems to be passing ultimately benefits himself as well. You know, didn't he pass some kind of law that made it easier for land or wine growing or something? Then it turns out he's got a winery.
That information I'm not familiar with, but I am familiar with the Pansy Wong case, because what happened was that there's a company called Shipley and Wong, remember? Jenny Shipley, former New Zealand National Party Prime Minister? Well, what happened was Shipley and Wong, the business address for that company was 735 Dannemora Road, which just happened to be Pansy Wong's electorate office address, and I took this to the Office of the Auditor General, and what did they do about it? Nothing. Well, my good friend Grace Hayden, who's another whistleblower and anti-corruption campaigner, she's initiated a petition calling for New Zealand to legislate to set up an independent commission against corruption, which is a great move. So that's another one of our main planks in terms of the action plan to prevent corruption, white-collar crime and corporate welfare. That's another step that's in place. I've actually got a live petition which is calling for an enforceable code of conduct for New Zealand judges. What else has happened very recently is the Green Party have got a private members bill pulled out of the ballot, which is for a register of lobbyists. That's huge, because in New Zealand, how do we know who's meeting the minister? Because in other countries like Australia, Canada, etc., if you're a third-party lobbyist and you're meeting, you want to get a meeting with the minister, you can't unless you're on a register of lobbyists. And so the public can have some transparency in terms of who is meeting the minister and on what. Because at the moment, apparently, there are lobbyists who have their own swipe cards to get into Parliament in Wellington. Now, how dodgy is that?
Very freaky.
Well, it is. So
it makes the whole situation rather incestuous, because then you don't know who the government is and who's running the government. It's obviously becoming less about the elected officials and more about these unelected people who just kind of have get sweetheart deals from the government and what have you, and just come on here, get tax breaks and get contracts and this kind of thing. It's almost like New Zealand is a succulent pig on a spit, and it's being rotated nicely, and these big business interests just come in every now and again, slice off a big chunk of it, and at the end, the people we get to eat last, when there's nothing left but a skeleton with a few strips of perhaps flesh, sinew, and fat left.
Well, the thing is that it's about exposing how the system works, but I tell you right now, National and ACT, they are extremely vulnerable, in my view, on issues related to corruption and white-collar crime. And over this last couple of weeks, the conflict of interest has been the words that have really picked up traction. And in my view, the thing is to continue to focus on these issues. And I believe that this is, well, because of course what's coming up in New Zealand is, there's a big push. Aotearoa New Zealand is not for sale. And there's going to be a march in Auckland on the 28th of April, starting at 3 o'clock at Britomart. And what's happening, there's a hikoi, which is like a march, Māori word for like a march, heading from up north down to Parliament. And I hope to be part of that, because what I really want to see is that this campaign against Aotearoa New Zealand not being for sale to incorporate this action plan, because it's through corruption and white collar crime that this is happening. Because who's pushing for this stuff? Who's lobbying the government? Whose interests are being served? Because the fact of the matter is that most mums and dads in New Zealand, they're struggling to pay their power bills. Never mind having spare money to invest in power companies, which we already own anyway. So it's like, it's all about looking after investors. Well, I put it to you that investors aren't the public majority, most of whom are just struggling on a week-by-week basis to pay the bills and put food on the table.
Where's the end goal for these people here? I mean, as far as I see it, have you ever heard of John Perkins, the economic hitman?
Oh, yes, I have.
So I think that's what John Key is. He's an economic hitman. He's been sent here by the bankster elite to destroy this country, to sell it out for their interests.
To me, that just seems just patently obvious. And, I mean, what gets me is the role of corporate media in terms of the spin doctoring that's accompanied John Key. I mean, you've got a Wall Street bankster who's dodgy as, who's been known to do insider trading, because I took a private prosecution, as you know, against John Key back in 2008 over Transrail.
That was when we first met, and he's only gotten worse.
Well, exactly right. So the thing is that the opportunities for insider trading when you're the Prime Minister are absolutely enormous, don't you think? I mean, you've got access to information that pretty much nobody else has, all the intelligence service, the whole nine yards. So if your real interest or intention is to set up a country to open it up for the banksters and big overseas investors, my God, I mean, it's really scary stuff. So I just think it's really important that to absolutely focus on this conflict of interest issue. Just another point I'd like to make regarding this Bathurst Resources Limited. Now, you remember there's a whistleblower called Jacob Cohen who put out a 50-page sort of booklet, Was It Murder at Pike River Mine? And with the benefit of hindsight, that came out in sort of January last year.
We'll have to get into more of this after the break. Penny Bright is my guest. We've got one more segment with her, and then in the second hour, Roy Harlow from Rush FM in Hamilton will be joining us. So that'll be fun too. Penny Bright, ladies and gentlemen, waterpressure.wordpress.com. Call in over the break, 218-339-8525. Back in a minute. Please don't desert me. But I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles. But I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not welcome back. So until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that welcome I'm back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about 29 solutions for compatibility. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And I think, I'm currently the only Kiwi with an American-based talk radio show? So this is good. Hopefully everybody else in the American audience isn't getting too bored with us talking about New Zealand and the copious quantities of scumbaggery that's going on here. But then again, a lot of New Zealanders will listen into the American radio shows and listen to the scumbaggery that's going on here and go, oh, wow, actually, the same stuff is happening at home as it is overseas every time. So you can listen to somebody exposing scumbaggery in any country, and you can be guaranteed that the exact same thing is going on right at home. And this is the good part about having a global truther movement, is we can all work together and we can all focus on our own little things, and they automatically apply pretty much everywhere in much the same way. And Penny Bright's been campaigning for Goodness knows. How long has it been now, Penny, that you've been an activist and general thorn in the side of the scumbags in Parliament?
Well, I'm in my 58th year, and I became an activist when I was 18. But we will.
Right.
Oh, we will. Yeah.
It takes a toll on you, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm not yet in my prime. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting, but I mean, you know, you end up with experience that you won't get out of a book, and what you find is that things overlap and that your skills you develop in one area become really useful somewhere completely different. So, no, it's all good. But, just before I get more back into Pike River Mine, I'd just like to say, as an activist, one of the big lessons that I'd like to pass on to everyone else out there was if you deal with matters on an issue-by-issue basis, it took me 50 years to work this one out, then that's how you maximise your effectiveness. Because if everyone has to agree on everything, you'll have three people, and that ain't effective. So you can agree on some things and agree to disagree on others or have a civilised debate about it, but that's the secret, in my view, is you work on an issue-by-issue basis.
I think that's absolutely true, and it dovetails with something that I've said a lot, because I actually learned it on early on in the piece, that it doesn't matter whether somebody's a socialist or a right-winger or anything like that. You'll find, if you keep talking to them just in an open and honest manner, that they're generally just good people and they will agree with reasonable things. And what you should do then is take that agreement that you have with these people who perhaps may in general just have an opposing view and just run with it, because you'll never get anything accomplished if your goal is not to agree with people, but your goal is just to argue with people.
Well, you never get anywhere. Well, the other thing I've learned as well is that it's through debate that you sharpen up your own arguments, because everyone agrees with everybody, then you don't actually sort of, you know, sharpen the debate, and you need to have an opposing viewpoint, and it makes you think more. And I mean, that's what it should be about. Freedom of expression is all about being able to have debate the issues without getting personal and nasty, you know, and that's another really important thing as well. But anyway, back to this Pike River coal mine. What happened here, for people not familiar with this, back on November the 19th, 2010, there was a massive methane explosion at Pike River coal mine, and 29 miners ended up dying. And when that first happened, the police were called in to supervise, take control of the situation, which is pretty much coal mining. There was no attempt.
Oh, Penny's dropped off there again. It's unfortunate. We do have a little bit of technical difficulties here. Hopefully she'll be able to come back up in a few minutes. What I was thinking is that this whole Pike River mine thing, and for those of you who don't know, 19 miners died. I almost said 19 hijackers. 19, or was it 26? Or something around that. Tens of people died, and it's come up as like this big mystery, and the trial's still going on, still don't know what caused it or anything like that, and this dude has written a document called Murder at Pike River Mine, which I thought was very, very interesting. I haven't read the document as yet, but there's a couple of interesting flags to mention. For instance, the first people on the scene would probably have been police, right? Because police get to those situations. Once an emergency is called, policeman's the first to arrive to a scene. The policeman who arrived first on the scene was very surprised that the New Zealand Army was already there. Allegedly, a demolitions division. Following this massive explosion in the mine, which killed a whole bunch of people, that conveniently served as a massive pretext for the government to start saying that going down into regular mines is too dangerous, and now we need to start open cast mining in national parks, which is precisely what the government has been trying to do this whole time. So just think about the convenience of it. And think about the suspicion of it. Why were the military there? Why were they? How did they get there before the police who got the emergency call out of it? See, the suspicious mind in me kind of goes, I think that they might have just blown it up as a pretext. Maybe they murdered them. Maybe they just used it as a pretext to get their agenda through. I don't know. But what I do know is that when you're talking about a West Coast town with miners, and miners are a very close-knit community, as I've heard. My father was a miner in Australia at one point. And what happens is this community kind of comes together, and they're all in shock, absolute devastating shock. And they're miserable. They're completely upset. The safety standards at the mine were about as laxative gets. You know, we have like two inspectors or something like that through the whole country to inspect every single mine in the place. It's insane. There's like virtually no fail-safe mechanisms. The escape route that they were supposed to get up was like a ladder going up through a hole in the roof sort of thing. And nobody had ever even done a single drill on that ladder. Not to mention, even if they did, they'd find it really hard to get out. You ever try getting up on a ladder when you've got nothing but space around you? It's not actually that hard because you can just get up there. You don't have to worry about where your elbows are going, where your knees are going, or how far back you are, or where your head's going, or anything like that. You don't have any of these things. Whereas in Pike River, on the other hand, they had a ladder going straight up through a hole. And that's notoriously difficult to get yourself out of, let alone getting yourself out of in a hurry, let alone getting yourself up with another 20-odd people coming up at the exact same time while you're running away from a fracking fireball. You know, it's insane. And what I find truly diabolical about all of this is not the lack safety procedures. It's not the government's evil agenda or whatever. It's the fact that the owners and all of those people involved with Pike River are remaining very tight-lipped about it, and they're not taking any responsibility for any of their failings. And also another terrible part about it is that the families can never have any peace because of this. Okay, the families themselves have lost their men, and it's just too much for them to bear. You know, imagine you lost a loved one, and you would never find out why or how it happened. And imagine if you wanted to go get their bodies, and you can, but there's a bunch of bureaucratic douchebags there who say that, oh, it's too dangerous, oh, you can't go in there, you can't do that, you can't... Can't do anything. It's a shame. And I feel that it's something that the country really needs to be cognizant of, that these types of big, wide-scale industrial accidents, they often occur in suspicious circumstances. For instance, do you remember a while back, I think it might have been in Chile or Argentina or something like that, one of the big mines collapsed and those guys were stuck down there for a couple of weeks or whatever, and they had to drill a hole down to bring them up in these baskets and this bizarre birthing ceremony sort of thing. And the machine that they were using to do that was called the Phoenix 2. What does the Phoenix do? It rises from the ashes. So that's nice and occult there, isn't it? What happened the day before that, that they all went down into that mine? Oh, wait, didn't they get all new uniforms with great sun symbolism and stuff all over the place? And there was a whole bunch of other freaky coincidences as well, allegedly. So you have a look at these big industrial accidents, and you wonder to yourself, was it really an accident? Does everything stack up? And in many cases, no, it doesn't. I'm afraid that you are basically, and I include myself in this, we're merely pawns to be sacrificed in some crazed maniac's game. And I mean that in a very serious sense, because these people who would do such things, who would stage such events, are obviously completely nutty. Okay, it's something that we have to pay more attention to, mainly because it's about innocent people and protecting them from the whims of diabolical scumbaggery. That's all I have to say about that. Coming up next segment, we'll have Roy Harlow from Rush FM in Hamilton, the very first New Zealand radio station to start playing the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen.
And that of everyone you know depends on it. Women and children, front lines, log on, tune in, stand and be counted. Wounded station in the belly of the vulture. Wash your back, there's no civilians. Women, children, front lines, listen. Consider this a distant early warning. The fire's imminent, pollution gathering dust particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation to fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.